Welcome to episode 6 of the 1987 WNBC radio documentary, The New York Knicks, Those Championship Seasons. I'm Bud Mishkin. This is a 9-episode series that I originally wrote and produced and created in 1987, voiced by my then WNBC radio colleague Gary Bridges, about one of the most beloved teams in American sports history, the New York Knicks of the late 60s and early 70s. When you think of rivals of the New York Knicks, you think of the rivalries in the 90s with the Bulls, the Pacers, and the Heat, and prior to that, the Celtics and the Lakers. But the most intense rivalry in the late 60s and early 70s was with a team called the Baltimore Bullets. In episode 6 of the New York Knicks, Those Championship Seasons, once again, it's the Knicks and the Bullets.
In those championship seasons of the early 70s, the Knicks had several hot rivalries. They came up against the Lakers 3 times in 4 years in the finals of the NBA championships. In the East, they played Boston, then and now the NBA's most successful franchise. But the blood rivals then were the Baltimore Bullets. The Knicks faced them in the playoffs every year from 1969 to 1974, and both sides came expecting a war. In those days, Knicks announcer Jim Carvallis called the action for the Bullets, and he says the grudge was born when the Knicks beat the Bullets in 1969.
That was the year that the Colts got knocked off by the Jets, and the Orioles got knocked off by the Mets. That was that same, and here this was the third Baltimore team that got crucified, but that's what started the rivalry, because New York was, wasn't a very good winner. And the Bullets weren't a very good loser, and there was a rivalry that started based on that first upset, and it carried over into one of the great rivalries in sports history.
When you think of the old Bullets, the mind goes first to the Pearl, Earl Monroe.
When Earl first came with the club, he was a little nervous, although he wouldn't admit it, and he came in with a lot of hype, and he came into a bigoted city. He came into a southern city. Baltimore was a bigoted city, and so he wasn't immediately accepted, and he didn't really play well until midway in his rookie year, and he seemed everyone got used to his spin move, including the referees. He got used to seeing his spin move and not calling it a travel, and then Earl started to come into himself, and from that point on, he was unstoppable.
Teammate Jack Maron.
It was subtle. It was a fluidity that where he tended to be able to feel where the defensive guy was, and he didn't have to overpower him. He didn't have to leap over him. He just tended to find a little opening, and when he did, he penetrated it. He was always under control. You never saw him rush the shot. He was very, very unusual player. I don't think I've ever seen anybody quite like him.
Dick Barnett had to try and guard him.
Monroe was a tough man. Walt and I rotated on him. If Monroe would make 3 or 4 on me, then Red would indicate let him see a different face so he could score 3 or 4 on Walt. But Monroe was a tough man to neutralize, and the only thing that you could do, not only with Monroe, Robinson, West, any number of individuals, just try to make them work harder. Stay in front of them, play good positional defense, not reach for the ball. Those are some of the things that you did when you played those guys.
Center Wes Unseld joined the Bullets in 1968 and led them to a divisional title.
There was some question about Unseld. They said he was 6'8", but he was really 6'6½", and he's going to play center in the NBA against Chamberlain and Bill Russell, and, give me a break. But he was terrific. He was one of the great rebounders and release passers of all time, and that's what the club needed because they had enough flashy players. They had the Gus Johnsons to run and the Earl Monroes and the Kevin Lockerys and the Marins, and he was the missing link.
Jack Maron.
We just ran, and the Knicks shut that down, and it took us, literally took us 2 years to figure out how to manage that, and we finally did and won in the Garden in 7.
Then post-columnist Larry Merchant.
It was so intense on the court, and because it was intense on the court, also in the stands, that it felt like there were 18,000 people inside the ball.
102 apiece, 10 seconds to go. Now Monroe is double-teamed, bumps into Barnett, Knicks thought they had a foul call. Monroe drives right, 2 seconds, spins away, he jumps, buzzer sounds, no good, no good. And we go to overtime. Mendy Rudolph with the ball. DeBuscher with the hands up. Johnson is looking. He one bounces to Monroe at midcourt. 20 seconds remaining as Monroe holds the ball. 16 seconds now as he veers to his left. Guarded by Frazier. He's to the top of the key with 12 seconds remaining. Almost lost the dribble. Now double team. Cuts to his right. 8 seconds remaining. Double team along the right sideline. Cuts to his left with 5 seconds. Loses the ball. Down. He drives down the lane. Lays it up. It is no good. But a whistle on the play. Let's see if they score it. Claim goaltending, but it is not going to count. We will go to a second overtime.
Everybody understood what was going on. It was DeBuscher against Johnson. It was Reed against Unseld. It was Bradley against Marin. It was Frazier against Monroe. These were individual battles and team battles. Tremendously intense defense. Invariably, it went to the seventh game. And my recollection is that the experiences almost seemed cathartic.
Marv Albert.
And you had Marin and Bradley who would get into fights. Here's a guy from Duke. And a guy from Princeton, two of the more intelligent players in a game, and they'd be scratching and clawing. And Bradley had his dirty moments. He was one of the dirtier players in the league. He would do things, for example, Marin used to complain that Bradley would constantly tug on his shorts out of sight of the officials. They couldn't see. He'd be holding the guy down.
Bill was a very tenacious player, and the preparation simply was that one couldn't relax at all on the floor. You couldn't relax on offense because if you relaxed on offense, you just were going to get shut out of the offense. And he couldn't relax on defense because he was such a good shooter and he could also help other people on the floor.
We were both competitors. We both used our teammates well to try to get shots. We both believed that there was a psychological dimension to the game. And so we had an interesting time. We took and gave to each other, but I wouldn't say we came to blows.
Jim Carvallis.
It's interesting because they were both very intelligent guys. They were both eventually would get into politics, and they're very cerebral type guys. And they were the ones, the civilized ones, were the ones that were fighting all the time.
At the other forward position, another titanic matchup, Dave DeBuscher and Gus Johnson.
Both of them were terrific defensive players. Of course, in DeBuscher's case, that didn't go unnoticed because New York is a sophisticated crowd, and he started defense. But Gus Johnson was as good a defensive player and the strongest guy that DeBuscher ever played against by his own admission. I remember Dave telling me one time that in those days the hand check was illegal, and he said, you know, Gus would put his hand on my hip, and it looked very innocent, but he was so strong that I was absolutely paralyzed in place. He said, that's why I took so many jump shots because I just couldn't drive anywhere.
The greatest thing I always remember about Gus Johnson was when I used to walk on the floor and they said, well, Gus is hurt and he's not playing tonight. And I thought, oh, God, thank God. Probably the strongest for his size of any individual I've ever played against. A great competitor. I mean, just a great athlete. Black and blue the next morning. You knew you'd been in a battle. One of the great competitors. He really never gave you a cheap shot, but he was tough. Just tough. And never said a word if you belted him back. He respected you if you belted him back. His thing was he would kill guys if you didn't hit him back. You'd go out there, we'd look at each other, let's get it on. He said, okay. It was... And we just go at it. It was a wonderful time.
Leonard Lewin.
Gus Johnson and DeBuscher, the classic matchup, those two. People would pay just to go to see those two play each other. And Gus Johnson, you know, I think people today don't know when they talk about Julius Irving inventing the flying dunk. The first fellow who ever did it was Gus Johnson. First time I ever saw it. Take off at the foul line. And go,
Walt Frazier.
We always won, but we lost because it took so much out of you physically and mentally. And usually it was a seven-game struggle down to the finish, and it was war.
Mike Reardon.
There were more of a freewheeling, fast-breaking, shoot the ball at any time type of team that was very dangerous to play because when they got on a roll, they were very difficult to stop.
Of the six times they met the Knicks in the playoffs, Baltimore would win only one. In 1971.
Gus Johnson was hobbled with a bad knee injury, which would eventually end his career. Kevin Lockery had sustained a very serious rib injury against Jabbar in Milwaukee and played with a harness the last half of the season. And so we ended up with John Tresvant, and we ended up with Fred Mad Dog Carter off the bench. And we really didn't figure to beat anybody. We had no real bench. And I think that's what really did the Knicks in. That they just couldn't take us seriously. And we won the seventh game at Madison Square Garden in one of the most incredible upsets, I think, of all time.
Willis Reed.
Last summer, talking with Kevin Lockery regarding the fact that he played on the Bullet team that beat us in 71 and then get beat seven games in a row, zip, four games in a row by Milwaukee. And Kevin was saying that, man, when we beat you guys, it's like we already won the championship.
November 10th, 1971 saw a dramatic change in the Knicks-Bullets rivalry. Dave Stallworth and Mike Reardon were sent to Baltimore, and Earl Monroe came to play in New York. Jim Carvallis.
Part of it had to do with a contractual thing. He didn't feel he was getting paid what he should be paid. And that triggered it, and then all of a sudden he started thinking of all the other things that were making him unhappy. And so then he said that he wanted to go, and they couldn't or wouldn't trade him, I don't know whichever, and so he just disappeared. He forced their hand. He absolutely disappeared, because for 3 or 4 days, the city of Baltimore was wondering whether Earl was in some alley somewhere in a can. They thought that maybe there was some foul play. So Earl just forced their hand.
Things hadn't been entirely rosy for Monroe in Baltimore.
He had made a statement after a game one time that he wouldn't go in the Army if he were drafted. And the statement was made to a reporter that he didn't like, and it was after a loss, and the guy came in the locker room and said something to Earl about the Army, and he said, "I'm not going in anyway." And so the next day it was headlines in the Baltimore papers, and he got a draft dodger sort of reputation. And things got very difficult for Earl Monroe. And I think all those things sort of added up. And he said, "I want to get out of here."
Bullets teammate Jack Maron.
I was quite bitter. I didn't like seeing Earl leave. I was, and I didn't understand some of the things that had gone on between him and management. And I tended to blame Earl. And Earl and I have talked since then about that. And he had. A difficult experience with the Bullets management, I guess. I don't guess. He told me it, and I believe that. And as a result, he issued a ultimatum to be traded, and he wanted to go to the Knicks. And as I look back from Earl's standpoint, I think it was a tremendous move on his part. It just was, it left me very bitter because I thought we were building something that could last.
Captain Willis Reed was glad to see Monroe come over.
I was always an Earl Monroe fan. I mean, you know, some people, some players you like and you admire because of their talent, and I was definitely an Earl Monroe fan. And you're talking about a guy who was happy to have him with us as opposed to playing against us.
But could Earl Monroe and Walt Frazier coexist in the same backcourt?
During those battles that we had, we gained a mutual respect. Because I didn't back down to him and he didn't back down to me. You know, we gave it 100% all the time. So we had that respect even though we were opponents. You know, it's different. Like sometimes a guy has a good night and the guy guarding him doesn't really want to guard him. But I know sometimes Earl got 35 points and every one he had to really struggle for. And he knew that and I knew it. So we had that respect. So when he came to the Knicks, you know, they were talking two basketballs and that type of thing, and it never happened because I think because of the respect that we have for each other, and we never let our egos in into the situation. When he was playing with the Knicks, when he was hot, I gave him the ball and vice versa.
Dave DeBuscher.
Walt and Earl, to me, in the same backcourt was the greatest backcourt without question that's ever been assembled. I don't think there's a – I mean, people can tell you that there were better backcourts, but believe me, there wasn't. Those are the two greatest players together in the backcourt I've ever seen.
The trade meant fewer minutes for Dick Barnett.
In fact, Red asked me what did he think if they made the trade. And I said, I didn't have any problems. Well, it's fine. You must remember at that particular time that I was really on the downside of my career. I think I was about 34 years old, and Earl probably was late 20s or whatever. So I knew Earl was going to be playing after I left. So it to me, business-wise, it made sense.
Not everyone was worried about Monroe's role with the Knicks. Leonard Lewin.
Earl Monroe was a basketball player. So if you could see, you saw the things he did, you knew that those two could play together. Because Earl could work without the ball. He could work with the ball. Clyde needed the ball more than Earl. But since Clyde was here first, you knew he was going to own the ball. So Earl had to make the adjustment. But you knew he was going to make it. He couldn't miss.
Marv Albert.
They both altered their game slightly to the point where they worked so well together. They really played a little bit more understated than when they were when Earl was in Baltimore and Clyde was with the Knicks, and it worked extremely well. And Monroe also occasionally played some tough defense too, and turned out to be one of the most well-liked players on the team.
Though they continued to play in the same division, Jim Carvallis says the nature of the rivalry changed when the Bullets moved to Landover, Maryland.
The different cities had something to do with it because it was Baltimore Bullets.
Yeah.
You know, it was like the Sacramento Kings and the Kansas City Kings. Although they were the same teams, we don't think of them as the same teams. And somehow I don't think that the people here can ever feel that the Washington Bullets were really the Baltimore Bullets.
But for anyone who was there, the memories are indelible of those games between the Bullets and the Knicks.
You were naturally excited from the moment you walked into the arena because there was an electricity when you walked into the Garden or into the Civic Center in Baltimore. So they were the easiest games I've ever had to do.
New York basketball fans use the memory of those championships as a way of marking a certain era in their lives. For one Knick fan in particular, it'll always mark the beginnings of his dreams realized. That story next.
Unless you had a ticket to Madison Square Garden or were one of the few who had cable in New York in the late 60s and early 70s, the only way to keep up with Knicks home games in those days was to listen to the radio. And a very emotional bond was formed between the team's fans and the young radio play-by-play announcer, Marv Albert. That story next time on Episode 7 of the New York Knicks, Those Championship Seasons. Thanks for listening. I'm Bud Mishkin.